Welcome to the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. I'm Kara Hansel-Keehan. Listeners, today we're bringing you a roundtable discussion with the entire AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology editorial team, reinforcing rigor and reproducibility expectations for use of sex and gender in cardiovascular research, which published October 11th, 2021. Joining me are Editor-in-Chief Mary Lindsay, Deputy Editor Zam Kasiri, Associate Editors Amanda LeBlanc, Crystal Ripplinger, Jonathan Kirk, Petra Kleinbongard, Keith Brunt, and Jason Carter, along with special guest host Nisha Charkoudian. Let's get started. Nisha?
Thanks, Kara. As biomedical researchers, we do our best every day to think about science in a comprehensive, quantitative, and rigorous manner. Although it has never been a secret that men and women are fundamentally different in terms of both reproductive and non-reproductive physiology, until somewhat recently, the differences have often been viewed as if women were a kind of special population and men were kind of the default or typical human. This has also been true in large part for animal models and cell lines where male has been the default and or sex has not been considered at all. In more recent years, however, these issues have improved with increasing consideration of sex as a biological variable over time. In the present editorial, the team of editors have summarized the goals and expectations of AJP Heart over the next several years in terms of optimizing rigorous approaches in this regard. As one author scientist in our community, I'd like to say that this editorial is very welcome, and I'm looking forward to discussing the various perspectives with members of the team. Mary, I'd like to start by thanking you for your leadership in this issue as editor-in-chief of AJP Heart and Circ. Could you summarize the goals of the journal in publishing this editorial? And what do you imagine will be some of the challenges in implementing your plan to require use of both sexes or genders or have strong scientific rationale not to, beginning in January of 2023?
Nisha, thank you for your comments. Our editorial group uses Team to communicate. And one day, Crystal mentioned that a reviewer had given strong comments to a manuscript that had used only male mice with no scientific justification. That reviewer wanted the authors to put in the title, quote, in male mice, quote. And that started a whole conversation amongst us on exactly how that could be interpreted. In this case, it meant that they only tested male mice. It could, however, be misconstrued to mean that the mechanism only occurred in male mice. After a lot of back and forth, we decided to evaluate our journal for how we were doing in terms of reporting and use of sex and gender. Our results show that while we are doing a good job to report sex and gender, we're actually not doing a very good job, particularly in animal studies, to actually use both sexes. From there, the idea grew to go ahead and give a time limit for final transition to fully considering sex as a biological variable. By January 2023, AJP Heart and Circ expects authors to use both males and females, men and women, for their studies. This editorial was a way to announce this decision and explain our thinking. We also have a new call out spurred from this discussion. I would like to highlight that the title of the new call is Considering Sex as a Biological Variable in Cardiovascular Research. This means that any study that uses both sex qualifies for this call, whether or not there are actual differences between sexes. We're as interested in no difference articles as we are in those that show differences. Our team is pretty excited about this update and bringing our journal to where it needs to be. I'm going to let my co-editors discuss with you, you know, some of the anticipated challenges and where we think this is going to go from here.
Kara, I'd like to turn to you and ask, do you at the journal have any plans to help the transition go more easily for investigators?
Thanks, Nisha. We anticipated that this might be a bit of a challenge. And so we're relying on our SciScore tool, which is an AI tool that scans the methods section and reports on use of sex as a biological variable when it's detected in the methods. That report is then provided to both peer reviewers and editors, so it assists in the peer review process. And as well, we have a call for papers on sex as a biological variable.
that will also incorporate and bring together our Getting It Right call for papers. So they're both designed to help researchers really drill down into the logistics of how to account for sex as a biological variable and not see this as daunting or insurmountable, but really to help break down the how-tos, if you will, of getting it done.
Great. Thank you so much, Kara. Next, I'd like to ask a few members of the team to comment on how a renewed focus on sex as a biological variable is relevant in their specific model system or sub-area. I think it's a little bit different, as much as it's an important consideration for everybody, I think it's a little bit different in each type of study design that you might think about. So I'll start with Jason. Could you talk a bit about the implications for research in human subjects? What are some common reasons that investigators use for not using both sexes that just don't hold up scientifically?
Thanks, Nisha. Great questions. Let's start with the first. What implications does this rigor have for research in human subjects? Put very simply, it's only going to make the research stronger, period. I'm not sure if you remember this, Nisha, but first time you and I met was at the American Autonomic Society meeting when Emma Hart was still working in the lab with you and Mike Joyner as a postdoc. Seems like a lifetime ago, but at that meeting, which was in the early 2000s. Do you remember that? Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
At that meeting, which was in the early 2000s, I presented what ended up being my first of many, many studies examining sex differences. And this one in particular, which coincidentally was published in AJP Heart, was on neural cardiovascular responses to mental stress. And you and Emma came flying up and we chatted for about 15 minutes straight after the talk and throughout the rest of the conference. That was the same time your lab was showing differences between men and women with regards to cardiac output and MSNA, and our data were in alignment. And this was really just the beginnings of many autonomic labs embracing sex as a key biological variable before it was the cool thing to do, right? And scientists like yourself, Emma, Paul Fidel's lab, Chi Fu's lab, Von Maysfield's lab, and many other human autonomic labs were among the first to truly embrace the importance of sex as a biological variable. And all of those laboratories have done very well with sustained and impactful scholarship over the years. So I guess what I would say to all of our listeners, and especially our up-and-coming junior investigators that we value so much at this journal, not only is this the right thing to do, you can see that early adopters have remained funded and on the cutting edge of autonomic research in humans. Second, and very briefly, common reasons for not using sex. You'll often see people try to cite, well, quote, there's too much variability in women or cost or something along those. And those reasons are often untrue or they can be totally mitigated. And with regard to variability, most autonomic studies that I'm familiar with in humans simply control for menstrual phase or oral contraceptive phase. Some even allow a mix to increase generalizability and ecological validity by inclusion as a covariate. And remember, this editorial does not call for every paper to study sex differences, but simply account for sex as a reported variable and inclusion of both sexes unless there is really strong scientific justification. And then finally, the so-called, quote, variability of women has actually become a major treasure chest of scientific inquiry as we've seen how rhythmic sex steroid changes provide key physiological insights we would have never gleaned from only studying 75 to 80 kilogram men. Yes, it takes some forethought, and in particular in longitudinal designs, to ensure that women are tested in similar phases, but that's simply a scheduling issue that any good grad student or technician should be able to handle. We cannot allow these inconveniences to get in the way of good science. As far as costs go, again, I would say that that can be solved or mitigated with foresight by including sex as a potential aim in grants. Indeed, NIH and other funding agencies have really helped in this regard in recent years by prioritizing sex as a biological variable. So I'm optimistic and there's good progress as outlined in this editorial, but our work is definitely not finished and we need to accelerate this as a foundational expectation, which is why I'm so proud to be part of this remarkable effort at AJP Heart and Circ to take this issue head on.
So I'll just turn to both Crystal and Jonathan at this point and ask if you could each comment on these aspects of sex as a biological variable for research in cell and animal models. And I think we'll start with Crystal to maybe talk about the mouse model, which is relevant to a lot of our scientists.
Thank you very much, Nisha. So I think I'd like to just expand a little bit on what Jason was mentioning, that not every study needs to be a study aimed at looking at sex differences. We just are encouraging researchers to begin to really acknowledge sex as a biological variable. And so for a lot of researchers who use rodents or other animal models, the initial thought is, oh no, now I have to double all my animal numbers for every single experiment. And that may not necessarily be true. We understand that as people work to include sex as a biological variable, that just including the opposite sex is a step in the right direction. So it's okay if not every study is statistically powered to specifically address differences between males and females. As long as we are including both sexes and reporting that clearly in the data, even if data then hint at sex differences, authors can acknowledge that in their manuscript, and then that can pave the way for future studies to examine those sex differences. So we're not asking that every study be sufficiently powered to really rigorously examine sex differences. We are just wanting researchers to really begin to include both sexes in all studies so that we can move the field forward.
Now, some people obviously do work in non-rodent animal models. And, you know, sometimes that can include large animal models. And this could be a little bit challenging for labs doing large animal models and require a little bit more planning. But I think labs that do large animal models are used to having to do sort of extra layers of planning, all the additional regulations and so forth, and sort of more complex experimental design that comes out of using large animals, that it's reasonable to expect that these labs are already planning out their experiments in a much longer time frame than rodent models. And so we've tried to give a fairly large heads up to the community here in order to provide them really a sufficient amount of time to replan some of their experimental design over the next year, year and a half, as they're doing even large animal studies, to prepare for this as they see it coming. And also, large animal studies also often involve fewer number of total animals than a rodent study or so forth. And so the need to provide equal numbers of male and female large animals will require fewer overall animals to address this.
Thanks, Jonathan and Crystal. That was really a helpful thought process. Keith, did you have something to say in that point?
Yeah, I was going to take it bidirectionally. I think when we're considering small and large animals, we have to extend that into human trials. And it's important to recognize the differential and proper use of terminology. For example, sex, when we're dealing with clinical charted data that's been assessed by a medical professional, and gender, when the participants in a clinical study are given the opportunity to declare their gender and to make sure that we're using those terms appropriately. And then, in clinical trials, that becomes really important for primary and secondary outcomes. And it's important to consider also what is known a priori in the literature about any pre-existing literature on the subject of sex as it affects the mechanisms or the drugs under study or the approaches. And then likewise, from moving even further back into cell culture, you know, simple approaches can be deployed and new techniques and training are available to help query some of those sex questions that might be relatable to hormones, but might not always be relatable to hormones. So we often see people promote, you know, a test with estrogen or testosterone, but it's important to remember that there's genetic components to sex as well that might feature in cell culture experiments. And so it's good to know a little bit about your cell culture approach and how you're designing to incorporate that if you are investigating sex, or at the very least, how you report it in your methods.
Thanks, Keith. I would like to come back to the issue of clinical trials and drug approval by the FDA. But before we do that, I wanted to just get back to Jonathan to see if he had any comments, additional comments about how this rigor associated with sex as a biological variable affects experiments in cell models.
Yeah, I mean, it is important to remember that every cell that we use also has a sex, even though it doesn't have a gonad attached to the cell. That is still something that needs to be taken into consideration. And, you know, one easy way, I think, to sort of conceptualize this is my lab does a lot of experiments in neonatal rat ventricular myocytes. And so when we prepare those cells from the neonatal rats, we're getting a mixture of both male and female rats in there, and they're combined into just one analysis. We wouldn't even take them apart and separate them, even if we could. And, you know, that's kind of what you think about, that they're both in there in the mix together, both sexes. We don't necessarily have to tease apart sex differences in every study we're doing, as long as they're both included in there. So in studies like in NRVMs, we're including both sexes to begin with. And of course, then picking cell lines and cell models where you can include both sexes of cells in your experimental design, I think is important going forward.
Definitely. Definitely. Thanks, Jonathan. I would like to come back to something that Keith brought up and see if Keith and Petra have additional thoughts on this. I thought an interesting point in the editorial was the aspect related to failure of clinical trials and or withdrawal of drugs by the FDA because of a lack of work in female animals or women leading up to FDA approval, which ultimately resulted in the drug not functioning appropriately in the actual human population. So Petra, maybe I'll turn to you at this point and ask your thoughts on this aspect.
Yeah, this is aspect is really, really important, Nisha. So I think in cardiovascular research, it is a huge, let me say, difficulty sometimes to find a balanced study populations of females and males. And the FDA has done many, many actions and proposed many guidelines and guidance to try to push the understanding of sex differences in the right direction. And let me go in details. In 2016, they have a guidance of diverse women in clinical trials initiative. And they really push to look for the gender balance and the sex balance in all clinical trials and try to raise the awareness about the importance of participation of the different groups of women in clinical research and share the best practice about clinical research design, recruitment, and subpopulations and analysis. And I think this is what we have to do at first. Let's go into the subpopulations and look for both sexes, both genders, and then do a good analysis and have more data available on this point.
Thanks, Petra. I think those are very important points. I'll mention that I think it's outside the scope of this podcast, but we'll see where the discussion goes. I believe we're not, as a journal, trying to say that we're in any way trying to be exclusive of people who are non-binary or that sex is or gender is in fact binary. We do recognize that it is a continuum, but Keith, I wonder if you have any other thoughts in that area.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that, you know, when we're documenting medications that we consider hormone therapy and transition as a potential, even when we're asking the basic design questions, you know, for surveys, are we creating an open opportunity for people to declare a gender apart from their sex of birth that might be medically charted? I think those are important aspects to feature. I think it's also important to recognize from a clinical perspective that there's definitely an intersectional component between sex and gender. So there's gender roles that occur in work and in life and family units that can lead somebody to present clinically at a delayed effect. So they may not even be entering a clinical trial in equipoise. So it may not be so simple to say that we need 50-50 balance in males and females for a clinical study, but rather understand how those patients are presenting clinically. For example, in our heart center, we sometimes see a trend in gender effect for presentation of urgency, even conversion from waitlist to urgent need for surgery. So if that occurs, then it might undermine some of the outcomes that you've designed into your clinical trial. So to the FDA point was quite interesting to reflect on too, because even when there was a good proportion of patients that were female, some studies that were conducted gave a false sense of security for safety because the power simply wasn't there adequately during the sub-studies. And that could be a dangerous point as we move into phase four. So, you know, there should definitely be some caution, both for the regulatory perspective as well as for the peer reviewers when they're looking at clinical studies in that sort of framework.
Thanks, Keith. I feel like these are all huge topics and we're touching on each one briefly, but unfortunately we don't have 5 hours to do this podcast. I'm not sure if anyone would listen to a 5-hour podcast. So I will switch gears here and please feel free to chime back in if you think of additional comments. One of the aspects that I've been thinking about recently is the career and professional aspects of a sex as a biological variable focus. I think I was overly optimistic, let's say 10 years ago, with regard to women in science as professionals. And I've been surprised in recent years that students and junior scientists have commented several times to me that it's helpful to see me as a woman scientist being successful in our field. So I was wondering if we could switch briefly to the career development aspect, and I'll ask Zam first and then Amanda to comment on the career development aspects for this discussion.
Thank you, Nisha. You're absolutely correct. There used to be a time that female scientists or female students would shy away from a career in science just because the way it seems to be so time demanding, which it is. And by default, usually the family responsibilities fall on the female of the partner of the couple. And there's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes we want it to be that way, but I think the winning ticket that women have in any career, which maybe subconsciously has been acknowledged or not, is that we are very good in multitasking and using our time efficiently. And I think that has been the winning ticket for a lot of women, like you mentioned, Nisha, yourself, who've been very successful in research. It's not easy by any means, but if it is something that you're interested in, and all female students in the undergraduate science program, they should recognize this, that if this is something that you're interested in, there is absolutely a way to be done. And that's because women in general, we are very good in planning things, in using our time efficiently, and in multitasking.
Thank you. I think those are all really important points. I think there's also something about seeing people who look like you, in a sense. And that gets into a whole other discussion about race and ethnicity, which we don't have time to discuss today. But Amanda, I was wondering if you have any additional thoughts on the career development aspects of this topic.
Absolutely. I would say that I was fortunate enough to come through Judy Mueller-Delp's lab for my doctoral training. And we focused on researching a disease that was specific to women. And as such, we kind of felt like we were filling a much needed niche in the early 2000s. And flash forward to the present, while some investigators that haven't given sex as a biological variable much consideration in the past could initially see this call as a potential hindrance to publishing. You know, when you think of current standards for some of the high impact journals, that you need to show this mechanistic insight, as well as submitting a complete story in a manuscript. And as such, that could potentially make a slower step in career advancement. But I want to point out that I like to think of this call as really an opportunity to do something first, being the first to either find or not find potential sex differences in our established fields is pretty exciting to me. And I think it's really an attitude that all of us can pass down to our trainees so that this mindset really continues and is established in the future.
Thanks, Amanda. I completely agree. And I think that's a really good way of looking at it. Any of us on this podcast or folks listening can all relate to something that was very challenging, whether it was related to sex as a biological variable or not, when we initially started to do it or when we were students. And those are some of the things that have helped us all grow and develop as scientists. So I think those are actually excellent, very, very important points.
I just want to add that, you know, I think it's important for my male colleagues to also support women in the sciences, whether that's, you know, helping at the right time in the bench to work with organic solvents, for example, during times where pregnancy or breastfeeding prevents people from doing that. But in general, just looking at opportunities and being cognizant of the fact that we shouldn't expect our female colleagues to be responsible for doing all the sex and gender work in the cardiovascular sciences, that it's really a community that has to be supportive of this. So there's different aspects and roles that men have to be aware of too, as we support women scientists and promoting our colleagues.
Thank you, Keith. I just saw Crystal put up a clapping hands thing. And I was just going to say, if we were having this conversation in person, I just had an emotional moment. Like I would just go over and hug you, even though I know we have not met in person. So thank you very much for those comments. And genuinely, I'm having like an emotional response to your comments right now.
I think that Keith brought up a really good point, because I do feel like over the past decade or so, a lot of the important sex differences work has been led by women investigators, which is great. But that shouldn't be the default either. I think having gender balance in terms of the things that we study and our priorities as scientists is also so very important.
Thanks, Crystal. Yes, I could not agree more. And as Jason pointed out, his lab started doing this a long time ago. I would say that in my experience, at least, it does tend to be a little bit of a default that someone will look to the women investigators when they're thinking about people who are going to be running trials related to sex as a biological variable or related to sex or gender differences. So I would now like to ask everyone, throw it out to the team, if any of you have a one or two sentence take-home message for this podcast.
I'd also like to add here that, you know, we say that studies in only one sex or gender won't be considered without strong scientific rationale. A strong scientific rationale can be that that sex or gender has been ignored in a century of previous studies. So this is just a huge opportunity to start to correct that glaring omission in the literature. And focusing on a single sex to fill those gaps is, I think, a very strong scientific rationale.
I'd just like to add on to that, that I think that this is not going to be as hard to do as we worry about right now. I think that overall, this is going to be something very feasible.
Thanks, Mary. I think those are really important points.
And maybe we want to conclude and say, okay, maybe we need a little bit more time to plan an experiment. Maybe we need a little bit more time to plan to order and breed, for example, large animals, but just do it and you will see the results speak for her own.
Yeah, I would agree with Petra. I think this does just take a little bit more thinking through, a little bit more foresight. And the great thing about studying sex differences now that our lab's been doing it for 20 plus years is that it really does lead to better and better questions the more we dig into this issue, just like anything in science. And inconveniences are not an excuse anymore. And I would agree. I don't think that this needs to be as hard as people think it will be. You start in steps and you take the step to begin to report. And then sooner or later, you're going to start to get some compelling preliminary data that's going to drive more and more impactful questions moving forward.
So what I'm hearing here a lot is that change is an iterative approach. We keep making science better. And I think that's the goal. And for new trainees that are listening to this, you know, recognize that this is a niche opportunity for them to get certification, to learn more about how to design experiments around sex and gender. And fundamentally, as we go through any change process, reach out to us, you know, follow us on Twitter, tweet at us. You know, we'd love to have a discussion like this by email or in social media. So it's a great opportunity to just open the field and make sure you're not trying to answer questions in a vacuum, that we're here to help. We're not here to gatekeep everything.
I really like that Keith brought this up in terms of sex and gender being a niche opportunity and to reach out to us as associate editors, because I really feel like AJP is a great place for this in terms of we're here with the primary goal of helping have better science. And I think that it's very much a two-way street here. We're here to help you, and you guys are here to submit the best science to the field. And I really feel like we all do this in a very constructive way, not as the gatekeepers, as Keith was saying. And so with that, I think that it's also important to highlight our ongoing push for the Getting It Right series, where we're asking the field to really come together and say, this is how we think the best science is going to be conducted and then eventually published.
Just to bring it all together, like any other change, this is going to be an effort that has to be made by all the scientists in this field. And when we look back at this in 5 to 10 years, we will be happy that we did this, because by including the both sexes and both genders in our studies, we will be opening new doors and bring up new questions that by answering them, we will have pushed the field much further than we will if we don't do this.
Most importantly, we're all on the same page, and we know that we can't answer all questions or solve all challenges with one podcast or one call for papers. But this is a good start. Hopefully, this discussion will stimulate further discussion and attention to this important issue.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the AJP Heart and Zerk podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.